GSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia, broadcasting from the unceded territories of the Coast Salish peoples.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, ZKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, we look at the rise of the extreme right in Canada and Bubble Pop. Talk about a recent report unpacking the changing status of endangered species in BC on the environment in Canada. Investigate the importance of challenging political complacency in a time of rising fascist politics on Free City Radio. And discuss the illusion of convenience that AI offers on Cyborg Goddess. But first, this episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lines books release, Troubling Criminology. In the book, Professors C.K. Ma and Mike Larson untangle the discipline of criminology and encourage readers to draw on their own experiences and perspectives, fostering dialogue and collaborative thinking in a series of insightful conversations looking at how crime, justice, and deviance are socially constructed, shaped by historical and cultural contexts, and influenced by power, inequality, and systemic oppression. Founded in 1977, Between the Lines publishes nonfiction books that expose and challenge oppression in Canadian society. Find your copy of Troubling Criminology at btlbooks.com. And this episode of Harbinger Showcase is also brought to you by Canada's progressive journalism community, Unrigged. Launched in 2023 as a response to Meta's Canadian news ban, Unrigged.ca is a one-stop website aggregating and updating new journalism on the hour, including podcasts, videos, newsletters, and in-depth reporting from publishers like Briar Patch in Regina, The Grind in Toronto, The Independent in St. John, plus national publications like Press Progress, The Breach, The Maple, and 23 more. Bookmark the site and make it your daily destination for Canadian news at unrigged.ca. And every week since February 2025, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist, Rachel Gilmore, breaks down the main headlines so you don't have to doom scroll on Bubble Pop. On this highlight from the season 2 premiere, Rachel welcomes Canadian Anti-Hate Network director Evan Balgord for a conversation investigating how far-right extremists are repackaging mass deportations using more politically palatable language. Now, here's the show.
Hello, I'm Rachel Gilmore, your least favorite person's least favorite journalist. Welcome to Bubble Pop. It's the weekly show where we talk about some of the biggest headlines and juiciest news tidbits so you don't have to doom scroll. And for season 2, as you can tell by me immediately stumbling on my words, we're doing it live, baby. So just a reminder that if you want to support the show, you can subscribe on Patreon, Substack, and YouTube, as well as wherever you like to listen. You can also use the super chat function on YouTube while we're live to ask questions, and we'll do our best to answer them at the end of the episode, provided they're not inappropriate. Now let's pop your bubble. Today we're talking about far-right extremism, from those weird little fight clubs to attempts to repackage mass deportations using more politically palatable language. And to help me do it, we're chatting with one of the country's foremost experts in far-right extremism. Evan Balgord is the executive director of the Canadian Anti-Hate Network, one of the country's top nonprofits that exposes hate and extremism. Evan, welcome to Bubble Pop.
Feels like there's not that much going on this week, huh?
I know, it's so boring and slow, yeah. Well, thank you for being my guinea pig for my first ever live episode. It's very exciting.
Yeah, happy to do it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. So we have some pretty chilling exclusive audio from the Canadian Anti-Hate Network that we will be reacting to live during this episode. It's from some extremist Twitter spaces where they really revealed a lot. These guys aren't as slick as they think they are, so this audio is pretty revealing in my opinion. But before we touch on that, I want to set the scene for our listeners. So as a very basic first question, Evan, can you give us a sense of the far-right extremist landscape in Canada? Like, who is it? What is it? And how has it shifted in recent months and years?
Sure. So I've been following this for about 10 years. The organization's been around for almost 8 years now. And a lot's changed in that time. And I think the biggest new change that I can think of is the kind of unification or consolidation of white nationalists in Canada. So there used to be all sorts of groups, all sorts of names. There'd be a lot of infighting. Groups would pop up, go defunct. People would move between groups. That was the natural state of affairs. And over the last year or so, that's kind of changed. So I'm sure many of your listeners and viewers know about Diagalon. But, you know, this is a collection of streamers that popped up many years ago. And they would look at news of the day and give, you know, racist and anti-Semitic reactions to it. And when they were doing this, they built an audience, and some of their streams will have views in the tens of thousands. They weren't content just to do that. They started up a more militant branch they called Second Sons Canada Now, that's doing training led by veterans of the Canadian Armed Forces. And Second Sons Canada is part of the broader Active Club Network, which are these more militant groups of white nationalists and sometimes neo-Nazis who get together to train, do fitness, but also to do mixed martial arts. And more recently, there's been another organization that's popped up that's federally incorporated called the Dominion Society of Canada. And now they're like the political wing. So if Diagalon is content creators, propaganda, Second Son Canada is the militant wing, and the Dominion Society of Canada is the political wing. And they lay out their agenda quite clearly that they want to criticize and control the Conservative Party of Canada so that their people, and this is them saying it, not me making a wild allegation, they're saying it, so that their people on the inside of the Conservative Party of Canada can use the space that they create. They really want them to adopt a more racist immigration platform as like the main platform, the Conservative Party of Canada. So the white nationalist movement in Canada, larger than it's ever been, has a militant wing with chapters across the country and has a specific political agenda. So this white nationalist movement, you know, this is sort of, that's not all of the far right. You know, there's still the convoy types who are, you know, waiting to be engaged. Some of them are doing like political workshops and targeting local races, like trying to become like school board trustees and city councilors. So there's still the broader far right movement that's going on. But the big change is the unification of the white nationalist movement.
Wow. Yeah, it's startling. You know, last time I had you on, we were talking about all of this, and it's fascinating to see how even in the months since your last appearance on Bubble Pop, there's been even more of a shift. And one of those is what you mentioned about the growing offline organization, specifically with respect to these active clubs. So we're going to touch on the Dominion Society and the remigration sort of political arm and the audio that proves what you were just saying. But before we do that, can you tell our listeners about this more militant arm? Like, what is an active club?
Right. So an active club is, you can think of like different variations of white nationalism. It's how the white nationalists talk about this themselves. They'll say like white nationalism 1.0 was what you think about when you think of like your daddies or your granddaddies, like skinhead Nazis, right? Boneheads. White nationalism 2.0 was the alt-right movement. So it was these extremely online young men who would create memes, really galvanized around Gamergate and the presidency of Donald Trump. And it sort of culminated in Charlottesville. Many of the figures that are now associated with the alt-right have, they've certainly already sort of had their day in the sun, and they're on the wane, right? Like a lot of these, the more prominent figures like Richard Spencer and stuff aren't popular or really that influential anymore. And also seen as very cringe, you know, extremely online, seem like they're not serious. They don't go out in the real world and do stuff. So that's when we got to white nationalism 3.0 and the active clubs. It was a response to the alt-right. And the idea was, we're going to get people offline. We're going to meet up in person, and we're going to start training and preparing and still advancing kind of the same political agenda where they want to have their white ethno state, you know, majority, super majority white population countries and what have you. The active club model is now pretty popular across the United States, Canada, and Europe. where they are a bit more close-knit, a bit more careful about how they recruit, and they'll go into the woods and do training. Sometimes that training is more militant. Sometimes it's more on the side of like a bunch of guys getting together to punch each other in shorts, like doing MMA stuff. Yeah.
That's so embarrassing.
it is a little embarrassing. But the problem is, of course, when it's not funny anymore. Well, we've seen groups following the active club models who are also based off of more militant neo-Nazi organizing elsewhere. That has been violent. So, you know, there's certain a celebration and glorification of violence. And sometimes it's more than just these guys punching each other in shorts, right?
Right. And we saw an example of, one of these active clubs doing sort of a public demonstration, Diaghilon, who, I think we both remember, as you already mentioned, when they were just claiming to be comedians and live streamers. And but they gathered in, and I'll pull up an article for anyone watching on video to take a peek at here. They gathered in the Niagara area to do this sort of offline display of force and numbers, where they just yelled a bunch of stuff and did these sort of pseudo military drills. So what's going on there? Like, what has changed within Diaghilon to go from this sort of online live streamer, you know, pretending to just be comedians and telling you it's a meme whenever you suggested something more serious, to them taking it clearly much more seriously and trying to do these intimidating gatherings in public?
So the whole "we're just comedians, it's just a meme" thing, in my opinion, that was never really true, right? When you watch the streams, I don't know what kind of humor appeals to different kind of people, but I take Jeremy McKenzie at face value when he says, you know, horrifically racist things and anti-Semitic things, right? I take him at face value when he does those things, or when he yells "gun or rope" when he is talking about his perceived political enemies, right? There is not a world in which presenting yourself like that to this audience is a joke. In terms of like, when did they get expressly political? Hard to say. We know during their tour across the country, I believe there was a leaked audio clip or something of one of their meetings where I think it was Derek, who's another one of their live streamers, was talking about how, you know, it started as a joke, but now it's not a joke because they realized that they're being discussed politically by political people. So at what point they decided that that's what they want to do, I don't know. If I do want to speculate, though, as to why they're becoming more emboldened, Jeremy was facing a slew of charges, of which I think almost all or all of them were dropped or dismissed or what have you. I'm not going to get the legal language exactly right while we're live, but all of the charges, to the best of my recollection, have gone away. And I saw Jeremy after that period of time. I think that that was emboldening. I think after years of realizing that they're not facing very significant opposition, but also that they're not facing sort of any legal consequences, and the government isn't paying them the attention that perhaps it should. I think that they've become emboldened because of the lack of resistance, but I also think that they're getting overconfident for a number of reasons, and that their belief that there will be no consequences will be tested.
Interesting. So that's sort of the more militant side of things, right? But as you mentioned, there's also this sort of growing political side. And I have to say, this has really struck me, and I know that you guys have been preoccupied with this at the Canadian Anti-Hate Network. You published a really great piece recently on this question, which is the language of remigration being used to sort of normalize some of this far-right rhetoric in the mainstream. It actually seems to be, unfortunately, working in some countries, like in the US and in Europe as well. Why do you think that is? Why is this such an effective tactic?
it, like, re-migration, the concept is nothing new. The word may be newer, but the concept's nothing new. And I think before we delve like exactly what re-migration is, I think we have to, right? So re-migration being the idea that stopping immigration isn't enough, that in order to, you know, preserve a culture or identity of a country, you need to send people back, people who've migrated, they're back to wherever they are, right, in order to create the country that you want. And I'm using very gentle language about it, but like what we're talking about is people who want countries like Canada to be white and European. A bunch of things we could talk about there. Very little are they thinking about Indigenous folks who were here for generations previously.
No, they literally say on their website. Yeah, they literally say on their website that they want to establish a sort of national identity predicated around being a biculture, I think they said, or of English and French people, and a Christian nation. Like it's very interesting.
How they think it should be like 97% like white heritage Canadian or something like that.
Those an excerpt from a recent episode of Bubble Pop. Find the show archives wherever you get your podcasts at rachelgilmore.substack.com and at harbingermedianetwork.com. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase on your local campus and community radio station. I'm Harbinger director Andre Goulet in Montreal. This episode is brought to you by the new Between the Lanes Books release, Troubling Criminology, coming up next. Sierra Club's The Environment in Canada is a weekly podcast exploring climate change, biodiversity, renewable energy, and democracy with hosts Jessica Murray in Toronto and Connor Curtis in Montreal. On this highlight from a recent episode, Dr. Sarah Otto, Dr. Peter Thompson, and CPAWS BC campaigner Bryna Kagawa Vicentin joined the show to talk about a recent report looking at the changing status of endangered species in BC over the last 15 years. Now, here's the show.
Welcome to another episode of the Environment in Canada podcast, a podcast about the environment in Canada by Sierra Club Canada. I'm Connor Curtis, Head of Communications with Sierra Club Canada, and today our podcast is on a recent report that looks at the changing status of imperiled species in BC over the last 15 years in the absence of a dedicated provincial species at risk law, and reveals that species at risk in BC have risen, with most changes in status not reflecting genuine recovery. We're also going to have a small chat at the end about a recent announcement by the Alberta government that they want to be the proponent of an oil pipeline to the West Coast and what that might mean for BC. We went over time with today's episode because it was a great conversation, so I'm going to let everyone introduce themselves. But before we begin, just a reminder that you can take action on environmental issues by visiting sierraclub.ca. We have tons of petitions, other actions, events, and regular news updates you can sign up for on the homepage. You can also find Sierra Club Canada on social media, and you can listen to the Environment in Canada podcast on the Harbinger Media Network, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, and YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. This podcast also airs on CKUT Broadcast Radio in Montreal, 90.3 FM, bi-weekly on Tuesdays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Don't forget to click follow or subscribe so you get the latest episodes from us. I'd also like to take this opportunity to recommend another podcast to you. It's called Cited. Cited is about the politics of science and research. Their new season is called Green Dreams. Each episode tells the story of a utopian thinker and their dreams for a green future. You'll learn about prominent environmental theorists across the ideological spectrum, and about some lesser-known figures that operate in the shadows. Should we make these green dreams a reality, or are they actually nightmares? Catch Green Dreams at citedpodcast.com. That's at CITEDpodcast.com. So, Sally, Peter, Brenna, thank you so much for joining me today. Just before we get going, who are you and what do you do?
My name is Sally Otto. I'm a professor at the University of British Columbia. I've lived in this province for 30 years and I love it. I teach about evolution and biodiversity, and I also teach math to our students to help them connect the world and the patterns they see around us to fundamental processes.
And I'm Peter. Thank you for having us. I'm a postdoctoral fellow, basically means a researcher with a PhD. So my full-time job is to do research. I work on a whole lot of things, but the questions that most interest me are often to do with how can we as humans be the best citizens possible in service of wildlife and of biodiversity? And what can we do differently to help preserve and protect wildlife? So those are the questions that most excite me. And similar to Sally, I like to bring in a mathematical angle. I enjoy working with big data sets and numbers and trying to leverage some of those skills to answer new questions that are really urgent and difficult.
And I'm Brynna Cagall-Vizentine. I'm a campaigner for the lands and freshwater team for the BC chapter of the Canadian Parks and Wilderness Society. We're one of the oldest conservation nonprofits in Canada, and we work to protect more lands and waters and habitat for wildlife across the province. And most namely, kind of the thing that I'm responsible for is increasing public engagement and awareness of the government's commitment to protect 30% of lands and waters by 2030. And that's a commitment made both at the provincial level and the federal level. And super happy to be here. Not the biggest fan of math and data, so happy that that's in your department. I'm definitely more on the emotional side and figuring out, you know, how to get people to connect with nature emotionally, whether it's through art or creativity. So that's kind of my realm, and happy to be here.
On that note, both the emotional side and the mathematics side, I'm curious, you've got a new report out. It deals with species at risk, with biodiversity. Can you tell us a little bit about the project and what motivated you to take on the project and why it's important right now for BC?
BC is one of the most biodiverse provinces in the country. We have over 24,000 species that we know about, and there's even more that we don't know about in this province. And I, like most people who live in this province, we value nature. We are inspired when we go on hikes and see the beauty of this province. And they call it beautiful BC for a good reason. But, you know, I think many of the people who live here don't actually realize that there's no protections in place for species at risk, imperiled species in our province. And I think that's a big disconnect. There was a CEPAW study in 2023 that pointed out that over 80% of the public believes in the importance of protecting biodiversity and aims to improve those protections. So there's a mismatch. What's going on that we value the natural world so much, and yet we have very little legal protections for species at risk? So this project was aiming to see, well, maybe, so there's a federal law, it's called the Species at Risk Act, and it applies on federal lands and in waters, but federal lands in BC, that's only 1% of the province. So that means 99% of the province lacks a dedicated species at risk law to protect species. But maybe we're doing okay without laws. You know, we can do well with regulations, we can do well with policy, so maybe we're doing fine anyway. And so that really motivated this study. How are we doing? How have the number of species at risk, the imperiled, endangered species in our province, how have they been faring over the last 15 years?
I guess I can also say that, similarly to Sally, I really value biodiversity here in BC. I spend as much time as I can outside. I'm also a little bit of a bird watcher. And so the diversity of all living things in this province and in the lands and waters where I am so fortunate to live is something I really care about. And like Sally said, the Species at Risk Act is a wonderful initiative, a really amazing effort to protect wildlife in Canada, but it does have its limitations in that it only applies to federal land and water. So we have so much of this beautiful province here that is not covered by the Species at Risk Act. And to our knowledge, there's no existing sort of census or monitoring across the entire diversity of species in BC with respect to how these species are doing. And we do know that the data that would be necessary to generate such a study does exist, thanks to a lot of hard work that the provincial government has put into maintaining this really impressive BC Conservation Data Center. And this is a huge repository of every species that has been tracked, over 20,000 species that have been tracked and assessed and included in this huge database with information about the status of that species and information about how vulnerable those species are to extinction. If, in theory, one was able to take that data and compare it to historical versions of the repository, you would then be able to potentially draw a really concrete and exhaustive picture of how are things changing, at least over the past, say, 10 to 20 years, in terms of overall, what is biodiversity doing in British Columbia?
Yeah, and it's interesting you both note the way in which BC has an effect on how we view nature. I mean, like, I have lots of family in BC. I've been there quite a bit over my life. It always feels like nature on a grand scale, you know, on a sort of scale that is unique. The size of the mountains, the diversity, too, of landscapes. I mean, you have desert, you have rainforest, you have all these interesting microclimates within BC. I'm curious, what biodiversity trends have we seen or have you seen in BC over the past few decades?
What one would want is that the number of imperiled species that goes down, that we know that they're imperiled. We do what we need to do to protect them. And so we see fewer of them. And we saw the opposite. There's 16% more species at risk in this province than there was in 2008. And that represents 1,600 known species at risk at present. So that was the bad news, is that there's more species at risk. We dug in a little bit more to see, too, why were they changing? Why were species being added to the most imperiled list, which is called red listed in BC? That means they're endangered or threatened species. And unfortunately, more often when a species got added to the red list, it was for real reasons. Their habitat had declined, the threats to those species had increased. Whereas there were a lot of times where things seemed to get better, especially for plants. There was a time when it was like 1,000 species seemed to get better. They went from the red list to the blue list. Blue list is vulnerable, special concern, but not at that highly imperiled red classification. But almost all of those changes were non-genuine. Scientists had more information, or we used new methodology, or we discovered a population we didn't know about before. So that's not that the species actually got any better off. It's that we changed how we ranked it.
I'll try and provide some examples, because this genuine versus non-genuine thing, this was one of the most difficult parts of the study for us, was determining what species are genuine changes and what species have, at least there's not evidence to suggest that they have genuinely changed. So when we're thinking about a genuine change, we want to determine what is happening to biodiversity on the ground in BC. And so an example of a genuine change would be a species of bird that the population is declining rapidly and continues to decline. And so that would be a very high level of risk. And 10 years later, we go and we do a survey of this bird, and we're seeing now that the populations are starting to stabilize or even increase, or maybe the range is expanding. You know, we looked for this bird in Creston, BC 10 years ago, and we didn't find any, and now it's there. And maybe we would conclude now, we can say, okay, maybe things are working for this bird. You know, we've potentially implemented some conservation legislation or we've implemented some regulations that are helping this bird. We're going to say it's now blue listed, which, as Sally mentioned, is still considered at risk, but it's a lower level of risk of extinction. So that would be a genuine improvement, or as we call it in our study, a downlisting. It's going down from red to blue. An example of a non-genuine downlisting would be, let's say there's this dragonfly. And of course, dragonflies are very small. It's hard to know where dragonflies are. We don't know a lot about them. Let's say 10 years ago, the only thing we knew about this dragonfly is that there is this one little river valley somewhere in the far southeastern of BC, East Kootenays, where this dragonfly has been seen. And it's a very rare dragonfly in this river valley. In that situation, you would give that a red listing. You know, it's very small population, very vulnerable to being extinct from BC or extirpated from BC. Let's say in the time between assessments, so let's say after that conclusion of red listing, we were doing some surveys up in the Peace River region, and suddenly we found tons of these dragonflies all over the place. They appear to be very common. It's quite clear that this does not represent a population expansion so much as it represents new information. So we just didn't look there. We didn't look for this dragonfly. We'd never looked there before, but it turns out it was there, and it's quite possible that it's been there the whole time. So certainly with knowledge of this new giant population along the Peace River in northeastern BC, we would conclude maybe to downlist from red to blue because it represents now the population is not as threatened. And that's a great story too. It's great that we're doing more monitoring and finding these species in places where we didn't think they were. That's really important work. And it's also great to know that we thought this species was really, really rare in BC. And now